Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 154 on growing a 1,000-plus unit portfolio within a 20-minute driving radius with Jason Perro. Jason lives in Erie, Pennsylvania, which is the opposite corner of Pennsylvania from where I grew up and still do a large number of deals, right outside Philadelphia. The perspective to pay close attention to during this episode is the fact that Jason has built this portfolio in a small 20-minute driving radius of Erie, Pennsylvania, which is a market population, maybe about 295,000 people, give or take. One of my own personal preferences in real estate investing is very large MSAs, metropolitan service areas, with like 5 to 10 million people minimum. So like my theory is more houses and more deals, it just seems easier. Yet there is something to be said for a very well-constructed, centrally located portfolio. Many of the benefits and the investment theory will be shared here by Jason today. Shall we begin? Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. Jason Perro, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So we are just about the end of March here, 2020, coronavirus in the air and most of us shut down here. I'm in Chicago. Our city's under shutdown and it's happening, I'm sure, around the country. Whereabouts are you for the listeners so they can kind of get a perspective and you know, fill us in on what's going on there a little bit?
Yep. I am located in Erie, Pennsylvania. So that is the northwest corner of Pennsylvania. Roughly an hour and a half north of Pittsburgh and an hour and a half east of Cleveland and an hour and a half west of Buffalo.
Nice. I used to live in Grove City. I actually graduated from Grove City High School. So right north, right south from Erie there. So believe it or not. And then I grew up in Philadelphia, so I'm a Pennsylvania guy most of my life before I got to Chicago.
Gotcha. Yeah, I went to school about 10 minutes from Grove City at Westminster. So.
Nice. All right, cool.
Yeah.
So Jason, for people who may not have already stumbled upon your name, I know you're kind of a big player around the scene, certainly a big player in Erie, Pennsylvania in the real estate space. But could you give us kind of the Reader's Digest, sort of what your career looked like getting into real estate and what the business looks like today?
Sure. So my wife and I, we bought our first real estate investment, which was a duplex, back in 2001, a week before 9/11. We kept buying, you know, we both worked in medical sales. She was a pharmaceutical rep. I was a medical device sales rep, kept buying property and she left her job in 2010. I was able to leave mine in 2012. At that time we had about 300 units. Fast forward to today, we're at about 1,000 units. A third of that, which we've syndicated, you know, we're the sponsors and key principals on a couple syndication projects. And the other two-thirds of the portfolio we own ourselves without any partners.
Gotcha. So go ahead.
No, I was just saying everything we have is located in or around the Erie, Pennsylvania area. So currently still stuck in our own geographic location as well.
Yeah, I guess there's a case to be made either way. I mean, there's a lot of people who come on my show. Multifamily is a very popular topic, and it's, you know, kind of goes obviously one of two ways. Either people stick to the geographic area, can drive and, you know, check on the properties any given time of day or night from home within an hour or so. And then you have the other type of operator who doesn't mind hopping on a plane and prefers the Texas, Florida, you know, certain other markets that are around the country for whatever reasons they're buying. So I always like to hear which perspective, you know, you're sharing from. I think that's important, you know, whether it's a backyard kind of investment strategy versus, you know, the entire country and hopping on an airplane, which after what's going on lately, I don't know how excited people are going to be to jump on airplanes, right? Jeez.
Well, yeah, I know. It is a crazy time. I mean, I'm definitely not opposed to that that method, but I say, you know, our hometown has treated us very well over the last 19 plus years and in terms of investing. And, you know, we didn't know any different starting out. I think these days, if somebody's getting into syndication as a business model, it's a much more clear path that, hey, you could buy property across, you know, all across the country, and here's a method on how to do it. You know what, Erie served us well. I mean, I make the argument about tertiary markets and sometimes that, you know, they never really see the big booms, and they never really suffer too badly under an economic bust. And, you know, we'll find out if those words ring true here in a few weeks, but I'm not too overly concerned about the business side of things taking a hit here. Maybe some minor disruption, but overall, I think we're in pretty good shape to weather the storm.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree. So let's back it up a little bit in the story here. You know, medical sales, pharmaceutical sales, I think that's kind of like a traveling gig, right? Is that kind of, you're not home all the time, or did you have the ability to do that local?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, for the most part, most of those jobs don't require a ton of overnights. I mean, you're away for, you know, meetings every quarter or, you know, a few times a year. My wife's job is a pharmaceutical rep, and I started out that side of the business too. I mean, you're mainly just calling on doctor's offices. You know, you're home by mid to late afternoon every day. And then again, just traveling for training and business meetings and things like that. You know, on the medical sales side, you know, we had to do some overnights. I had a little bit larger of a sales territory, but nothing where, you know, it wasn't as though, you know, you're leaving Sunday night, coming home Friday night. We were able to be home most nights for dinner. Might be later, you know, later than normal, but I was able to kind of keep a reasonable enough balance back then. So, but there's a lot of windshield time, and that windshield time was the best time for me to, you know, listen to audiobooks, call our employees, you know, source deals, that type of thing. So I was able to use a lot of that to our advantage in terms of when we were growing the business.
Nice. So of the 300 or so units you had at that point, can you give me a breakdown of, like, I imagine, right, that some of them were a single family, and then maybe you started getting into multi, and then you started to kind of graduate toward one or the other, or maybe I'm totally wrong and you're still buying single family to this day, but it would be helpful to understand kind of the progression as you start to put together a 1,000-unit portfolio.
Yeah. So at that time, that when we left the day job, there was a you know, we had a few like 30 unit type complexes so all along we would, you know, we'd buy a, you know, a 2-unit, a 4-unit, didn't have much in the way of single family homes until 2008, when there was a glut of, you know, foreclosed properties that I saw I could buy a single family home for, you know, $10,000 or $15,000 in Erie, PA. And we could, you know, we could put money into the, you know, into fixing it up and then have, you know, just build equity that way. So we, you know, so there wasn't not a ton of single family homes till later on, but yeah, it was just kind of a broad mix of like a few 30 unit buildings, a few 16 to 20 unit buildings, and a bunch of, you know, 8 and 10 units, and then, you know, a whole bunch more of the singles and doubles.
And was the philosophy at that time when you were putting them together, was it, you know, hey, I like the paper losses combined with the cash flow? Am I buying like and trying to raise rents and force values? I mean, what was kind of going through your mind in the maybe the first 5 years of putting that together?
Well, the first 5 years, I mean, I was just trying to buy rental property. I mean, that's about all I knew. This is before, I don't want to say it was before the internet, but, you know, 19 years ago, it wasn't like it was today. You know, there was no Facebook. There was no Facebook groups. The real estate investing websites were not that abundant. You know, and there were some real estate investing books, but I was just, you know, we were, you know, buying a lot of, you know, duplexes, quads, that type of thing. And just, yeah, really looking where, hey, can I go in and raise the rents, you know, force some appreciation. I never wanted to sell anything, so I didn't care as much about the appreciation as I cared about the cash flow. And the reason for the cash flow was at some point to be able to leave, you know, be able to leave my day job and, you know, and have that be self-sustaining for my family and myself.
Who managed back then, and is it still the same way today?
So when we started out, it was my wife and I. We would, you know, she'll tell you I was probably the worst painter we ever had. So she would paint, and we would, you know, and I really was not handy. And that kind of forced us into, you know, as we grew, that was a real, like, you know, kind of not eye opening, but, you know, reassurance that we needed to grow so we could get me out of like fixing and painting and things like that. So, you know, I did the leasing, you know, and we would rent them out. So the first several years we did most of that ourselves. You know, I'd throw the, you know, push lawnmower in the back of a car and then, you know, go around and mow the lawns and stuff like that. So, 2005, I met a guy who became one of my biggest mentors in the business. But at the time, we had 23 units. He had 56 units, and we ended up purchasing those on. And he held the paper, so we bought the property. He held a mortgage for a little over, or right around $1 million, and that kind of, with that came our first maintenance guy. And when I realized, oh my gosh, there's all this work that we don't have to do, that we, you know, we can have somebody, you know, showing up every day, that was great. And then that was the time I was transitioning into some more demanding medical device positions. And we started having had our first child in 2005. So just the demands of life got to be more too. So, we hired a part-time property manager, kept buying real estate. So then that part-time manager went into a full-time manager. And so now, you know, all told, I've got, oh gosh, probably about on a given day, you know, between 22 and 24 employees, between our office staff and maintenance guys and leasing agents and things of that nature. So we still, you know, my wife and I are more of a, like the CEO role now, where we're really just calling the shots and making sure. And we've always done that, but now it's just on a much bigger scale. And so, having a team of people, when you're self-managing it, I mean, it's fantastic because, you know, you don't have, you can remove yourself from some, you know, from all the day-to-day kind of nonsense. And some people really do love paperwork, you know, so you can hire a good office manager to keep your paperwork straight. Some people really love numbers. So hiring a good accountant on staff or, you know, just so it took me a while to realize that, hey, there's a lot of things that I know I need to do, but I'm maybe not great at them. Well, how do I grow to a point where I can fill that, you know, put that person on the right seat on the bus and keep going forward.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. So to hear your story, Jason, you have this experience early on where, you know, you're buying the properties. It feels like a good idea. There's no bigger pockets. There's no all the stuff we have here. The podcast was not invented yet. I got in 2006 and there was still none of that kind of stuff around. You had to pay $5,000-$10,000 and go to a seminar or the real estate get riches kind of thing if you wanted any kind of info and then you have this self-managed experience. I think that's probably helpful for a lot of people in the beginning, because if you're not paying the guy to do the lawn mowing, and you're not paying, you know, the property manager the first month's rent, you're not paying the maintenance guy to do the paint and the turnover, at the end of the day you got a little bit of cash and you're kind of able to still go forward. Like my 25 or so units, which I treat as my kind of savings account, if you will. It's like, that's just like money in my savings. And at the end of the year, it's kind of like break even. It's not really making any money. I mean, my equity is good and the money's there and there's tax benefits and stuff like that. But I have a property manager in place. I don't do the repairs. I don't do any of that stuff. And like, that's probably the money that I'm missing that an investor would make early on. Now, we did 223 deals last year in 2019 alone between like 14 partners that we have. It's like 5 million plus in profit that we split up. So we're kind of busy doing that. And I'm like CEO role president, managing all that activity there with my partners. So I'm not counting on the rental income for my business. It's not my main business model, but I think it's also instructive and telling for your story to have then gone from doing all those things yourself to like, you know, here comes the guy with the other 56 units. Now I need this, you know, other person to do the bookkeeping, and you're able to assemble this team of 20 plus people that allows you to grow to that 1,000-unit portfolio. I mean, would you?
Right.
Was it accidental? Did it just kind of evolve that way, or were you very intentional about like putting a team together, knowing that you were going to grow to 1,000 units or so?
Well, the team, you know, that when we started self-managing, you know, I always had the goals that we wanted to grow to a certain point, or we knew that we would grow the business in a certain way. But it was organically, you know, I didn't just wake up and say, hey, I'm going to have 24 employees. I mean, you got to have the revenue to be able to support that payroll. So, you know, I went from two employees to three to five, and just kind of grew organically. And what I learned, it took me several years of learning, was just where are my pain points and where am I wasting most of my time that somebody else could do better. And so, you know, as we've grown, I've just now I'm trying to be very proactive. So, you know, we're closing a 127 unit deal here in a few months, and I know that that's going to require some other area in our staffing. And where's that going to, you know, where's that need going to arise? Is it maintenance? Is it, you know, management, paperwork, and where do we add, or where can we expand our support staff in that regard? So, I mean, now I'm very proactive about trying to identify our needs ahead of time, and as we do deals and try to scale our team as we scale the business, and we've had a lot of luck with taking the more of a proactive approach with it the last couple of years.
So I'm curious. So like I have the 20 some units and I own those exclusively, like meaning I have mortgages, but it's my money that was the down payment and there's no partners. I didn't syndicate any money to get that small portfolio. And you got to 300 and it was just your wife and you. And then you had like a third, I think you mentioned earlier here, that are in syndications now, but then two thirds, I'm assuming that you had prior. I'm wondering, why add the syndications now? Like for me, we have investors who invest on those single family flips. And I like the end date, you know, 6 months, 12 months, I pay them back. They give me the money again and it moves forward. I always had a hesitation, maybe a mental block of taking on syndications and then having 8, 10, 15, 20, 100 different people whose money I had. Yeah. And maybe it's just, you know, I'm scared to have other people's money for a longer period of time. I don't want to be responsible. Maybe it's kind of a personal thing, but I'm curious if you felt any of that and why choose to add the syndications after you kind of have reached a certain level of scale. Maybe you'd want to share your goals. It would help explain it maybe.
Sure. So, you know, I definitely had some mental blocks of my own when I was thinking about syndication. I think back in maybe 07 or 08, I started learning about it, and I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't wrap my head around, gosh, why would I want all these partners? To me, it seemed like there was these partnerships, and, man, why would I want to answer to 10 or 15 people and you know, or more? And it just seemed like I just didn't grasp the concept that, you know, the way a proper syndications can be done. And so as time went on, you know, I still kind of had these mental blocks about partnerships and syndications. And then about 5 years ago, I guess I met a guy who's a co-sponsor, co-GP on our syndications with my wife and I. And he's another prominent local business owner, had done some real estate, but he was primarily a farmer and had some other business interests. But, you know, we hit it off and we knew we wanted to do something in real estate together. Couldn't wrap my head around it. And I woke up one day and I just, you know, I realized that, you know, we can get into the types, the bigger properties, the, you know, maybe nicer property, large multifamily portfolios that, you know, traditionally, you know, if it's just a mom and pop operator, they'd either sell off a bunch of property to come up with a down payment for that, say, $10 million project, or they would have to go borrow against everything and over leverage again to get into those big projects. But I realized, like, hey, I can get ownership in this without having to put up all of my own money. Now, I've invested on the passive side of all of our syndications as well, but I realized, like, hey, I've got the control I want. People are investing in me and our team. And so with our partner, you know, his CFO does our books, does our distributions. She's in charge of the money. And I've realized that, like, wow, it's really great to have some awesome people on our team that are better at some of this than I am. So, you know, like, people trust in my wife and I, they trust in our track record, our operations, our history, our reputation, and having a partner that brings that kind of same thing to the table, you know, it's really a powerful combination. And so what I found is that, hey, we're able to grow into a larger, larger and better properties without having to risk everything ourselves. You know, we're able to share some of that risk, but at the same time, grow the way we want to grow. And you get into some of that larger property too. It is a little bit more stable and predictable than, you know, like a 100 unit complex is going to be far more predictable and stable than 100 single family homes. And, you know, less roofs to worry about, less furnaces, less, you know, electrical systems, like all of that. But at the end of the day, you know, it's just what I like after doing this for so long is that predictability. I mean, maybe the return is a little bit less, but I know month over month or quarter over after quarter that I'm able to, you know, that we're, you know, we're able to like, kind of have that like predictable stream of income as opposed to having, you know, maybe volatility or work that has to go into it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, when I look at your business model before and then the progression, when we talked about how you kind of built that management team, it would seem, I guess it's a natural progression, a natural growth path of larger scale. You've already got this kind of like this asset, this team who's used to like placing tenants, used to like, oh, this part of town rents for this amount. Oh, the maintenance guy can drive out and we're going to pay this amount. So there's a lot of knowns and a lot of experience there where, especially since you're kind of a boots on the ground investor, to add another 100, you know, 125, 127 units, it seems natural and it seems like it's, you know, complementary to that team. Rather than if I were to go out and buy 127 units, I'm going to have to build that whole team myself. And I've got a different kind of team that's built for something different. So like when someone brings a flip to me, Dan, you want to flip this house? Yeah, we just plug it in. We slipstream and it's like not a big deal. We'll close it out in a week and it's like no big thing. So that's that kind of feels right to me.
Yeah, we've been it's been a very natural progression, but we've been happy with how it's evolved and grown over the years, and just, you know, just excited for the future too. You know, what's next, and you know, get through this little kind of you know, kind of weird time with the coronavirus thing, and work through all the fallout of that. But we're still very optimistic about what things look like long term for real estate investment, and this will pose a lot of opportunity out there too for a lot of investors. I think, you know, the what happens in the next several months to a couple of years will still be a really good time for whether it's fix and flip, you know, wholesaling, you know, buy and hold, you know, syndication. I think it's still going to be a very strong market.
Yeah, I mean, I took a look at some of the economic data from the last, you know, when we had 2008, 9, and 10, we had systemic failure, meaning, you know, underwriting was not proper, so people were getting mortgages who shouldn't have had them, so that like false demand in the market inflated prices beyond where they should have been, and then we had like some demographic trends that came into play, like the baby boomers suddenly didn't need the McMansion size houses and their kids weren't quite through college and off on their own to be buying houses themselves. So there was like a demographic vacuum when you look at the ages out on the chart that kind of occurred at the same time as that systemic failure that was happening in 2008, 9, 10. So at the bottom of that market, 2010, 2011, I don't have it in front of me, but the number of homes that was transacted on a rolling 12-month period, I believe it was 3.45 million houses that closed. And in February of 2020, that we just passed here, right before the coronavirus had a chance to really settle in economically, that is, we had 5.7 million. And in January, we had 5.5 million. And a year before, January 19, we had, I think it was 5 million flat, right around there, maybe 5.4, something like that. So even in the depth of the market, we still had, you know, 60% of the transaction volume. In a country that was 10% smaller, so around 300 million people, we're about 330 million now. So that tells me, right, there's still deals transacting if it's fix and flip and all those kind of things, even in like the most, you know, deep, dull real estate market that we lived through. So I would hope that even if there's a fall off that comes about here where we have to deal with some unemployment, hotel workers, maybe everyone is a germaphobe and no one goes back out to eat once this whole thing clears. I mean, it's kind of going to be interesting to see the shifts in humanity and culture itself and what kind of impact that might have on certain types of businesses versus others as we kind of have to reorganize a bit. But I think you're right. I think for the most part, we're going to see a lot of people who had a plan on buying a house a year, 2 years, 3 years out, figure out a way to move those plans up to take advantage of these low interest rates. And like, I would hope that we're going to go into kind of like a 2002, 2003 kind of real estate boom cycle, although maybe not quite as vibrant since people have to qualify for mortgages. I mean, that was kind of that's the story I tell myself to fall asleep last night.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it helps to be positive and you know, and really, like, you know, like you said, I mean, a lot of the fundamentals are here. I mean, there's going to be some corrections, and it's going to hit some people probably particularly hard and others not as much. But I think that, I think we're in much better position because, you know, it wasn't, you know, we weren't in a broken system. I mean, this is something that's out of everybody's control. So it's going to take, you know, kind of collective sacrifice and collective effort to get out of and recover from. But I think that, you know, things will come back. It's just a matter of how quick, when they do, you know, and that could be 6 months, could be a couple of years. I mean, who knows, but it seems like things will head in the right direction pretty quickly here.
Cool. So let's talk about Erie, right? I assume all your properties are what, within an hour or two drive from where you're at now?
Everything's within about 20, 25 minutes of where we're at.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah.
So even tighter circle. So if you were going to sell me on Erie, I'm living in Chicago. I grew up right outside of Philadelphia. I mean, how would you describe the market to me in a way that made me feel better about that market, even in light of the coronavirus economic situation that we're dealing with? Like, we'll keep the virus risk, you know, separate from the conversation for now.
Sure. So I think one of the big things about Erie, and I've said this for, you know, 19 years, and I would say it to people that I worked with. I'd say it on every podcast I'm on the last couple of years, and I still believe I'm right. It's my opinion. But I think that when you're in a tertiary market, you know, oftentimes, like, the markets that seem to make sense, like in Erie, isn't reliant on one employer. You know, so we have a variety of employment opportunities. So healthcare, education, there's colleges, universities. There's also the largest medical college in the country, which is LECOM, which is one of the big employers in our area as well. So there's a lot of local economy. There's a lot of money coming from outside for those types of ventures. There's still a strong manufacturing base. So there's a diversity in jobs. We are located, it's not as though Erie's in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, you're an hour and a half, 2 hours to Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and 3 hours from Toronto. So you're a lot closer to these major metropolitan areas, you know, as opposed to, say, maybe some other tertiary markets. You know, the other thing is that the cost of living is lower. So if you took kind of a blended average of Erie and then the surrounding suburbs, it's about 80% of the cost of living of the national average, and how this translates into real estate investment. So, you know, what we always say is that you're never going to gain from the from an economic boom, but you're certainly going to you know, hopefully protect yourself from an economic bust. And what that looks like for me today is that, okay, if a third of my tenants, you know, all of a sudden are on unemployment. I have 300 people unemployed out of 1,000, as an example. Well, you know, our average rent in our portfolio is roughly, I mean, you know, say $700 a month. And so on $700 a month of monthly rental income, if they're collecting unemployment, looks like there's going to be some federal stimulus money getting passed today. Probably by the time your podcast gets released, it'll, you know, that'll have happened. But there's these, you know, societal guardrails in place that, you know, somebody will be able to afford their basics in life as you know, utilities and shelter and food and things like that. Unemployment covers most of that. Now, there will be some disruption and maybe the timing of the rent that comes in, and we may have to make, you know, we're not going to charge late fees, and we allow people to pay, you know, maybe, you know, kind of throughout the month, and we'll work with them a little bit. But by and large, you know, there should be very little disruption from the revenue standpoint of our business due to coronavirus. And as people go back to work, their jobs will come back and, you know, things will get back to normal. So I think it's going to, you know, take a little bit of creativity sometimes to work with people, but I don't see it just being, you know, unless there's something that comes out, you know, on a national level that says everybody's got a break from paying their bills. I don't anticipate too much of a hiccup here. And that's, so to me, if somebody's going to be sold on an area like Erie, you know, if I'm investing out of town, I personally don't want to be in a market where it's hot, because, you know, nobody saw coronavirus coming, and we all talked about, oh, hey, the market's booming and, you know, and, you know, this and that. But if, you know, if you're in the middle of a value add project in Atlanta, for instance, where you're counting on being able to push the rent to $250 or $300 a month, I would be a little nervous because the success of your project is then contingent on you being able to drive up the rents. And if we're in the middle of this kind of crazy economic time, that might be a little bit more of a challenge to do. We're able to push rents, but we're not going to buy something that's contingent on pushing something to an unrealistic, unsustainable level. And so maybe that's just kind of the conservative nature of the Rust Belt and towns like ours. But there's absolutely 100% people suffering in our town right now. It's not as though there's not, but I think that, there's that ability to still cover your basic needs financially when the world kind of goes sideways.
Yeah, and as you described the location, I'm thinking, at first, I'm going to be honest, like Erie felt like the other side of the world, because when I grew up and we looked at a map in second grade, Erie was like the complete other side of the state from Pennsylvania where we were, so it felt like the other side of the world. But as you describe it, I put myself in your shoes and say, oh, yeah, the location. And plus, you guys are right on Lake Erie. I mean, are there, like, little beachfronts and stuff and, like, kind of high-rises down there? What's the lakefront look like in Erie, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, there's so Presque Isle State Park is one of the heaviest trafficked state parks in the country. So it's a little-known gem that, I mean, we get a ton of, like, summertime tourism from, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland. A lot of Canadians come into town for the beachfront. So, Presque Isle's, people are going to kill me for getting it wrong, but I think it's like 7 miles long. So you can go the route like 6.5, 7 miles on one side and then loop around and it brings you back on the other side. But it's sandy beaches and beautiful sunsets. There's a lot of development going on in downtown Erie and along the bayfront. So we have this beautiful waterfront that used to be kind of dominated by like old smokestack, manufacturing facilities that, if you think back in the 1950s and, around that time where it was just dumping pollution into, and that was the waterfront. Well, now that's changing into, a lot more development and, retail and office space and just things to really utilize that waterfront as a draw for tourists, but also for the folks that want to work and live downtown. I mean, they want to live there, not like looking at the back of an alley or something like that. So, it's certainly not the most vibrant place in the world. I can't compare it to say a Portland, Oregon or a Nashville, Tennessee, but it's a nice little city, kind of a hidden gem, that's out there. So we really, really enjoy being here, and the cost of living is so low. So you can live like a king in a small town and then travel the world and see everything else that you want to, without having to pay an arm and a leg to live here.
Yeah, until I moved to Chicago 5 years ago, being near my daughter, she was out here since, me and her mom went our separate ways, years and years ago from Philly. But I never would have thought until I moved out here in 2015, like living on the lake. So I live on the lakefront, and I imagine it's kind of like Erie. It's like I look out the window and there's beaches out here. It's like, who ever thought Chicago was like a beach town? But that's how it is in the summertime. I think I heard Sam Zell, one of his earlier market strategies, and I don't know if that carried through. I don't think it did all the way until his recent years, but he was kind of a tertiary market investor because he felt like he could get, I think it was like 12 or 15% cash on cash return by buying multifamily stuff, 100, 150 unit on up, multifamily housing apartment buildings in these tertiary markets without the kind of competition that drives us to like, 6% cap rates in a city like Chicago with huge tax risk the way that the situation is. What are the expected cash on cash returns if you were going to be excited about the deal you're looking at for multifamily?
Sure. I mean, I think, we're generally, like if it's a multifamily deal, they're generally trading right now, where they were until, today it's a little bit of a standstill, but, they were trading in the sevens and eights. I like to have some juice in the deal. I don't want that to be a hard seven where there's no, where there's no upside.
Yeah.
So as an example, we're right now, this 127 units that we have under contract, it's a solid 8 cap with a lot of room to push the rents, a lot of room to, kind of the expenses were generally in line, but just basically normalize the revenue. Even with the market going the way it is, we still believe that there's some potential upside there across the board. So being able to take, say, a 7 or an 8 cap and turn that into something much better. So, if we're going to, so like in our multifamily deals, everybody, they talk about providing preferred returns and things like that. I don't love to do the extra math. I think it's just like, so the thing that kind of, I don't say it concerns me, but I see a lot of deals out there and people promise a preferred return. But the question is, are your limited partners actually receiving payback? I mean, it's great to think that you're going to be the first to get paid, but I have one of my coaching students in real estate. She lives out in LA and was telling me a few weeks back that she's invested in two deals where there's preferred returns, and one she's been in for a year and the other a year and a half, and says, well, I the one has paid me about $1,000 so far, and the other one I haven't gotten anything. But it's a preferred return. And so for me, I my model, it's like, look, we're going to do a straight split. It could vary by deal, but it could be, 80-20, 75-25, something along those lines. And we have our investors expect to get paid starting Q1. And, we're going to be able to operate a deal in the sense that there's going to be net profit to distribute, and they should expect at least an 8% annualized return. If it's a value add play, that'll go up, and that'll go up significantly, after a couple of years. But that's the way we try to model it. Not really do any crazy waterfall structures, not really do any crazy, anything that's too hard to explain or too hard for them to understand. It just like make the math as easy as possible and get people excited about having a good, stable, predictable return. And I don't think it's any more, shouldn't be any more difficult than that.
Do you guys pay monthly to your investors or quarterly?
Well, we do quarterly. I do have a couple, my wife and I do have a couple joint venture properties where the investment was made in terms of debt. So those guys are getting paid out monthly, but there's a few of those. But as far as the syndications are concerned, it's paid quarterly. So we'll do quarterly distributions, usually have our numbers reconciled, within the week or two at the close of the quarter. And, we see where things fall. If we can over distribute, we do. We've sort of learned to hold back sometimes if we have that extra cash just to be able to make sure that we provide that predictability for our investors. I think it's much better to, provide, say, an 8% annualized return. If you're just paying that out, the same amount every quarter, that's better than having it be wildly volatile, quarter over quarter. Just want to give people that kind of reassurance and that kind of stability and predictability, as I mentioned.
Yeah, and I mentioned, it feels good, certainly, like certain REITs I own and companies in the stock market, your dividend, and the dividend does not wildly fluctuate. I mean, the price might wildly fluctuate, but at the end of the year, right, you read an annual report and you can see that there's some extra cash in there. There's a little bit of prudence there. So I could definitely see the value from either side of the table of keeping that 8% kind of consistent, right?
Yep, for sure.
Your hold period on these, Jason, you said you don't like to sell anything. So when you have syndicated other people's funds, are they also in it for the long haul, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we generally for the syndications, we'll have a 10-year timeline. That is in line with generally the term of the loan that we've entered into. We're seeking agency debt. So if it's a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan with a 10-year term, we'll generally have that be the horizon to reevaluate the deal. So we'll look at market conditions. We'll look at how the property's performed, and we'll make that determination. Do we sell that? Do we refinance that and be able to have some sort of capital event where we, give people, some cash back? So we'll reevaluate those at 10 years. That's the expected hold period. And so if somebody wants out and they want to go their separate ways, that's fine. And if they want to, stay in the deal, but maybe on a more limited basis, that's going to be evaluated on a deal by deal, situation, just as they come up. And I think one of the things that, my wife and I and our partner in this that, we think that, hey, if it's been good to us long term and it's run well, if it's not broke, why fix it? But at the same time, it's hard to predict what type of opportunities and things will be out there. You know, if you bought something, say, for $10 million and have a chance to sell it for $20 million, you know, it might not be a bad day to take a payday or to refinance, get some cash out tax-free and keep it rolling, right? So I think you just have to look at the entirety of the situation of the partnership, of the local economy, and just see where everybody's at and just, you know, kind of take that survey, take it to heart, and really try to do the best thing for the partnership, you know, when that time frame comes.
So how many properties have you sold over the years?
I have sold about, so we've not sold any of our properties we've syndicated, but I've sold about 10 properties that multifamily properties that we bought. And as one of our large local employers has expanded, I've been the beneficiary of kind of standing in the path of progress. So whether they're buying property to, you know, to construct new office space or create more green space, you know, we've been able to sell to that in this case was Erie Insurance and really benefited from that. But I guess I'll caveat that I have sold off a lot of our smaller, like, singles and doubles and things like that, and maybe some tougher areas. I've kind of packaged a bunch of things and sold them via land contract to a couple different up and coming investors, and really try to, you know, be a mentor to them and get them started on the right path. So, ultimately I still own it until the land contract, runs its course. But that was like the beginning of the exit strategy for a lot of those types of properties.
And was it mostly troubling properties? They were causing a headache. Like, you sound like such a buy and hold forever kind of guy. That's why I'm kind of down this line of questioning. It's like, well, what would cause Jason Pirro to actually want to sell these off? I mean, what was like the motivator in those, besides Erie Insurance?
Well, yeah. Well, I think the key for like a lot of the smaller stuff, I mean, one hand, you know, I think about, well, how do I exit out of some of these properties and why would I sell them? I think, you know, at the time I was having some trouble with scaling the business appropriately to handle, on one hand, say maybe, you know, a handful of units in a tougher part of town. I mean, Erie's, you know, only so big and it's only so tough. So it's not like it was that bad, but you switching gears from that to say a large, like higher end, like, you know, 30 unit townhome complex. And you just found that from like a property management perspective, a maintenance perspective, really hard to standardize when there's like different types of properties in play. And then there was a lot more running around. So sort of in a way of being efficient, look, if I can take these off our plate, you know, that helps the daily operations. The other side of it is to be able to give those properties the proper attention. You know, I think it's something that has to be a lot more hands-on. And so I was able to then create that predictable stream of income as opposed to the volatility that can sometimes come with like a bunch of like smaller scattered types of properties. So, you know, if you have 50 duplexes, there's going to be a lot more volatility as opposed to like one 100 unit complex. And the thing is, it's one thing if that's all you do is run like one particular type of property, but it was getting to pose its challenges in terms of like, hey, we're over here at this one portfolio and now we're switching gears to go over this other portfolio. And that just, and I woke up and said, well, you know what, if our long-term goal is to syndicate and really, you know, start moving, keep moving into better properties, better areas, better everything, then we really need to start thinking about disposing of some of the smaller stuff. And I don't have any second thoughts about it at all. It's been very beneficial to the guys that have purchased it from us, but also for us to be able to free up that time and energy to move into new adventures.
Yeah, it makes sense. I feel like I'm personally at the same spot, although I'm not moving into the bigger portfolios and kind of stepping up. It's the growth in our single family, you know, flipping business that has caused me to look at my portfolio more as a distraction. But the tax benefits of hanging on to the stuff kind of has me in that conundrum of wanting to hang on, you know, a little bit longer. So I'm kind of torn, even though my numbers are way smaller than what you've got on a plate. I can understand the distraction factor being very important in deciding to sell off a couple of the properties.
Yep. No, that's cool. For sure. And that's it. Yeah, it's just about, I think, when I realized you had to be open to evolving your business plan, you know, there's nothing wrong with selling something and taking a profit, right? And selling something so you free up your time and energy to move into other areas. I mean, there's sometimes only so much you can do in a day, and something's going to suffer because you can't get to everything. So,
cool. So, Jason, you know, over the years, maybe you've recommended some books to some of the people, you do some coaching, or maybe some like really impactful books that would jump to mind that you would recommend to other people, maybe one or two, anything pop up?
Yeah. Two books that I love that I recommend every chance I get. The first is Poor Charlie's Almanac. So that's a collection of speeches and talks by Charlie Munger. You know, so he's the long-term vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. So everybody talks about, you know, Warren Buffett, but this is, you know, he's Warren Buffett's right-hand man. So it's a big book, and it's super entertaining, and it just gives you kind of a mindset for how to approach business, how to approach your investments, and just really helped me to start thinking about, you know, my business in a different way. So I usually kind of reread that once every year and a half or so, and I get a lot out of it. And then the other book that I recommend a lot is The Compound Effect by Darren Hardy. So Darren he's a personal development coach and a guru guy, but he was the publisher of Success Magazine. And the whole premise of the book is, you know, it's about, like, it's not all the big massive action and the big huge things that add up, but it's the countless, like, you know, small choices that really make the biggest difference at the end of the day. So the premise of just like the small daily choices you make, you know, is what compounds into the massive success that you're looking for at the end of the line.
Nice. I have both of those on my bookshelf. Both were impactful. I'm gonna pull down Poor Charlie's Almanac again and have to give that another read, because it was probably 3 or 4 years since I have read it. And I have read The Snowball, I think twice, about Warren Buffett. And he credits, and if you really read and follow Warren Buffett a lot, like, Warren Buffett is not Warren Buffett without Charlie Munger's influence throughout the years. So the conversation that Charlie and Warren were having, I mean, Warren kind of gets the spotlight. He's the larger shareholder in Berkshire. But, yeah, without Charlie, there was never going to be a Warren Buffett, I don't think. So, I mean,
right. Yeah.
Cool. So if you could go back and share with yourself, you know, the crown jewel of wisdom, maybe while you were still doing in medical sales and you were at property or unit door number 20 to 30, what would the crown jewel of wisdom be, Jason?
Yeah, I think one of the things that would have, if I could go back then, would just be to slow down and trust the process, that, you know, have faith that the plan's going to work. You know, I think I was obsessed at that time to a fault of just go, 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 and trying to set the world on fire and, you know, I don't know, prove something to no one, I guess, but just trying to say, well, I'm going to have all these units, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to make all this money, but really didn't have a purpose. And I just think that, you know, slowing down and really, you know, creating, you know, more defined goals and trying to have that kind of all around work life, you know, mental balance, would go much further. And I think we're always, as entrepreneurs, kind of geared towards, you know, go, 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 and always be creating and things like that. But I feel now, you know, I have a much better balance in terms of, you know, the time I spend with my wife, the time I spend with my kids, you know, being a good friend to my friends, and just, you know, but still giving the business the attention it needs. And so, I just think it was definitely very one-sided, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. I wonder if some of that just comes with maturity and age. I think I feel like that same spot, you know, I might even say the same thing to myself, but yeah, it's really good. Really good to be able to make sure, maybe as we mature and we get the experience, we start to figure out what is important. So you know which levers you got to focus on to kind of get the result. But early on, when you don't know, you got to run around and hit all the levers. I mean, you kind of got to be like a headless chicken on fire a little bit. But yeah, I wish you could take the experience back and start over. I mean, who knows, right? But I digress. Yeah. So, Jason, is there anywhere, if anyone wants to get some more information or contact you, that they should go?
Absolutely. They can hit me up on my website. That's perorealestate.com. Drop me an email. They can connect with me on LinkedIn, Facebook. It's fine. And then if anybody wants to hop on a quick, 10-15 minute strategy call, they can book time with me through my Calendly link, which is calendly.com/Jason Perro.
All right, cool. Hey, I appreciate you taking the time to share with me and the listeners of the wisdom. I have like a couple pages of notes here. I really appreciate it. I hope that you and your family and everybody in your town stay safe. And, of course, the same for everybody in the country here as we get through this. But, yeah, thank you for coming on the show, Jason.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, and I had a lot of fun with it.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Coming up on the next episode is a discussion with Brett Swartz and I on how to defer taxes on gains from any highly appreciated asset. Imagine selling a business and making a $10 million profit. There's no 1031 exchange for selling a business. It would be nice. Wouldn't you just love to have a strategy to turn right around and invest that entire $10 million into a variety of assets without first having to shell out that large percentage in state and federal taxes? That's the power of the deferred sales trust and the topic of the next episode, so you want to make sure to tune in and catch that one. Do you have a deal for sale? Do you need a buyer now? We have sold and settled 44 houses year to date and have 99 more in our inventory. We are a large volume shop, and we are still looking for more deals. Unlike many investors who are now corona restricted as a result of hard money lenders across the U.S. pushing pause on funding any more deals, we are a well-funded company through private sources, private resources, and long since established lines of credit with multiple banks, multiple lenders, and we are in big time buy mode. So if you have a deal, please either reply to my email or hit me up directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. I personally monitor both of those communication methods and pride myself on rapid responses. In other words, I'll make the decision quickly and get right back to you. Are you an accredited investor currently in the market for passive real estate investments that are completely hands-off, highly profitable, and return capital in a short time window, usually about 6 to 12 months or less? If so, head over to fundrehabdeals.com. This is how you can passively participate in my deal flow here at Diamond Equity. We are at the end, my friend. I will catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.